Father, thank you for your love. Thank you, Lord, that we can lift our hearts in earnest to you, confessing, Lord, how needy we truly are, how much and how desperately we need your presence and your meeting with us this hour. We cannot preach and we cannot listen apart from the ministry of the Holy Spirit. This we confess. And yet, Lord, with some small understanding of our need, we covet your presence. We ask for your speaking voice. We ask that your word may live in our hearts. And we pray, Father, that as now we turn our attention to it, and as it is presented in other, the junior church time and other venues here this morning, that the word of the Lord might be glorified and have free course in our midst. And we'll praise you and thank you for all that you accomplish, seen and unseen, in hearts and lives. In Jesus' precious name I pray. Amen. Well, we continue this morning with our series on commitment, kind of winding down to those final messages that I mentioned, and just keeping in mind a premise. And we struggle with this all the time, don't we? So it's not too hard, really, to kind of get you back into the groove. We can't do everything. Sometimes that gets frustrating. Do you ever feel that way? It just, so much is required of you, so much is expected of you, so many people are waiting on you for things, and you realize you just can't do everything. So at the end of the day, or sometimes at home or in other venues, you make a decision. Or sometimes you're just so busy and things slip by. And then you sort of have to live with the consequences of those decisions because people don't always understand. But it's a true thing in life, is it not? And the older we get, especially as our energies are less abundant, the more and more we realize this. Too bad in youth we didn't already realize it and covet God's presence and blessing in our lives the way sometimes now we do because we realize it all the more. But the same thing is true of commitment. When you're looking at the kind of full commitment that we described in thinking about Nicodemus, I'm going to take you back over that ground now, but we understand what God is looking for, and we understand that there are some things that certainly merit giving our time and attention to, but we can't be fully committed to everything. So what would it look like? How would we go to the Bible and try to figure out, you know, the preacher's been talking about this subject of commitment. I realize it's a challenge that I need. We all really need this challenge. So what would it look like? How would I figure out the things that I really know and can be comfortable in my heart that God wants me to give my all to? Well, the Bible is going to help us there, just like in every other question. The Bible has some answer somewhere, whether by precept or by principle. So we're going to look at this text this morning, and we started off with the whole idea of commitment, my worship. Genesis 2, verse 3. Isn't that interesting, those opening verses? God blessed the seventh day, sanctified it, because in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. So before any of these things that we're going to look at, and there are four of them, as I pointed out, four things in the beginning of the Bible, as creation is underway, God is mapping out exactly how life is going to be, those relationships and responsibilities that are going to form the fabric of life. Isn't it interesting where he starts? He starts with himself. And just to repeat something from last week, that's really a lesson we've just got to keep in view. That when you're thinking about priorities, God is the ultimate and first of all priorities, and that governs everything that comes after that point. Well, we looked at that last time, so I don't want to go over all of that ground again, but when you say that verse, if you missed the message last week perhaps, I might just quickly point out again, so that's talking about the Sabbath. Yeah, I know, but when you're talking about the Sabbath, you're talking about worship, and when you're talking about worship, you're talking about God. So the first message is commitment, my worship. Today, let's look at the second thing that we encounter in this chapter. We're going to really encounter three of them in this chapter, and by the time we get to chapter 9, we'll see the fourth of them, and that'll sort of be what I'm trying to do as I round out this series. Commitment, my marriage, and after that, commitment, my home, and after that, commitment, my country. It's government, but I think country is the better word for us to kind of latch on to something of a more practical nature. Now, here's something interesting, and what I want to do in the message this morning, before I get ahead of myself, I'll mention this to you. Two simple things I want to talk about in the message this morning. First of all, if we're going to talk about marriage, we could be here till next Christmas, so kind of have to delineate and limit what's here. But I want to talk, first of all, about the place of marriage. We're going to see something very interesting about that in this text, and you've already heard me maybe sort of prime the pump on this in this respect. But then we want to transition to looking at the purpose. Since God is the inventor of all of this, by the way, did you ever think about that? amongst all the manuals and counsel and things people say, all the way from Dr. Ruth to Ann Landers to whoever else you want to talk about. Of course, Ann Landers is no longer writing her columns. She's now figuring out whether the advice she gave is right or not. But God is the one that we can really count on, right? Not that there's not good folks, and not that there's not good seminars, and not that there's not good advice, but this is the whole thing right here. I mean, God is putting it for us, and if we can get a hold of what is in the Bible, and we're not going to get it all this morning, then we can really be confident that that's kind of how we should pursue things as we think about the subject of marriage. So purpose, and I'm going to give you three that we'll see. Very simple. Nothing really, it's profound and yet simple that we'll see this in the message, God willing, this morning. So I hope that you will open your hearts and give your kind attention to this. The thought about the place of marriage, this to me is incredibly instructive, because I already mentioned to you that since we're talking about the subject of priorities, we don't need to miss the order in which God puts the four. There's something about that that's incredibly instructive, because God is first, and everyone knows that, but I mean, it's interesting to see that's how it comes in the Bible. God is first. But you do make a transition when you get to the other three: marriage, the home, my country. Now we've done something that is, you see this analogy also in the law, right? In the Ten Commandments. We've moved from what sometimes people call the vertical. What's that? Man and his relationship to God. And most people understand the first four commandments, the first table of the law, sometimes we say that, deals with man's relationship to God. So it's the vertical. Things like, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. All of those four are vertical. They deal with man's relationship to God. But when you start getting to honor thy father and thy mother, thou shalt do no murder, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, that deals with man's relationship to man, horizontal, right? And so it's really easy now to see at least part of what Jesus was doing when he summarized the whole genius of the law from God's perspective. You can look at it that way. That's how he was able to distill it to two commandments, because it all has to do with loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the first commandment. That's man and his relationship to God. And we are miserable failures at that. Right? To be honest. Anyway, if someone doesn't think he's a sinner, just challenge him on that point. So you've loved God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. I don't think so. But then, the horizontal relationship, now that's what's happening here. You start with God. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Man in his relationship to God, worship, commitment, my worship. But when you start talking about marriage, the home, and your country, now you've transitioned from the vertical responsibility to the horizontal. Now here's something even more interesting. If you're, well, back up a sentence. So if I'm going to understand the key principle of being successful in the latter three, I have to start with the first one. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because there are so many people today, and, you know, churches recognize this. That's why some of them trying to grow their numbers capitalize on this. And I don't mean to say that some of it is not good, but, you know, they talk about marriage, the home, and run seminars and all this and try to get people in. But you know what? The very foundation of having a successful marriage and a successful home and understanding a relationship to your country is to have a right relationship with God. Because if he's not first in those things, it's all just human wisdom. But there's another point to be made, and the other point to be made is that when we come to the latter three, marriage, the home, my country, there is one that's absolutely foundational to the other two. We're still observing the priority in which God puts the priorities. Hello? Don't go to sleep on me, because if you miss this, you're going to miss something. It's not me, okay? This is not some, I didn't find some jewel somewhere in Bill Gothard or something like that, and I'm not denigrating him. This is in the Bible. This is what God says. So when you're thinking about these horizontal relationships, at least if you're already in the position of being married, that's the key. That's, maybe you call it the first among equals. It's kind of like Peter and the apostles. Do you know that? Kind of like Peter and the apostles. He was unquestionably their leader. Or let's change the analogy a little bit, and let's say it this way. You know, When you talk about the critical importance of a foundation, you're not disparaging the importance of the walls and roof, right? I mean, if someone says, you know, you've got to get this right, that's an issue in our community right now, or at least it's been well discussed, because they're building a new middle school, and people say, well, why are they doing that? And they say, well, because underneath it, it's not good. So now they're building one, and it's got, you know, piles or however you call that stuff. That's I grew up with that stuff, you know, because I grew up along the coast, and it was pretty common to build that way, put those things down. So regardless of where you are on this issue, on that particular local issue, everyone understands how important a good foundation is. But having said that, the whole reason some people are concerned is because they got cracks in the walls, right? And so they're concerned. So by talking about how critical and how important the foundation is, no one is saying that the walls are not important. You with me on my point? No one is saying that the roof is not important. When it rains, it's very important. When it's cold, it's very important. They're just saying that if you don't get the foundation right, you can have problems later with the walls. You can have problems later with the roof. And so it's really interesting to see what God is saying to us here. There is profound wisdom in this, to see how God is pointing out to us that, you know, you really can't have a strong home if you don't have a strong marriage. I mean, if you're in that situation, I'm not saying, I understand some people are not married, but I'm saying if you're in the typical family mode, I'm just telling you. So what happens? This is what happens sometimes with empty nesters and other people, or you often in marriage counseling, you'll come across this. People will say, well, you know, why do they get divorced when the kids are gone? Why is there so much of that? You ask me because it's, I don't know if it's epidemic, but it's very common in our culture. People get divorced after the kids are gone. Well, they don't know what to do with each other. A husband and wife don't know what to do with each other. They sit there and look at each other like, you know, and I remember, I don't want to embarrass, but it was one lady who was giving a prayer request about both daughters being gone, and all of a sudden she realized all of our kids are gone, and she said something in the prayer meeting about, well, oh, but you're in that situation too, aren't you? And I said, well, we'll manage. I love my kids. You just can't understand. I mean, yes, you can if you have your own kids. I love my kids, but I love my wife, and I'm not sitting around moping 24/7 because my kids aren't there. Kind of enjoying doing some things with my wife and spending even more time with her. What a great joy that is in life. But the whole reason that if you achieve any modicum of success, well, think about it this way. Did you know that your training, your grandchildren's parents? So what kind of mother and father are they going to be? If the only thing that held your marriage and your home together was them, and then it's gone because they're gone and you split up, or you just don't have that proper foundation, you haven't given them much. When they get out, what are they going to do? If, on the other hand, you have made a priority of your marriage, that doesn't mean you spend every waking moment on it, but if you have understood the key to this thing in God's wisdom and you have spent your time developing a strong relationship, guess what? They see it. They see it. And quietly, because this is the way kids are, because this is the way human nature is, they don't say much. They don't come along, you know, and say, wow, Mom, wow, Dad, you guys do a great job. We're just amazed at the job you do. You might hear that 20 years from now. They don't just come up and pin a medal on you, but they watch what you do. And you're giving them what they're going to take into their home and into their marriage. Doesn't mean that you're ultimately responsible for every mistake they make. But if you're serious about giving them the right kind of example and giving them the best that you can give them, be sure your own marriage is strong. Be sure that they see husbands loving their wives. You might have asked yourself this morning, why did we sing, "No one ever cared for me like Jesus"? Or why did we sing that first song about love? Well, it says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. It puts clothes on this subject of love because it's shown in actions and words and deeds, and our kids see that. And it's just absolutely crucial that we understand this. All right, I'm going to have to leave that because I want to have some time to talk about the purpose. So if God set this up, and there's a profound wisdom in just these simple thoughts, of observing the priority among the priorities. Why did God set this up? Why is marriage the first in the horizontal lineup? So that really having a strong marriage is the key to having a strong home, and strong homes are the key to having a strong country. What can we learn about how to have a strong marriage? And listen, I don't hang out a shingle. You know, there's some people, I guess, that do, and more power to them, I guess. I counsel every Sunday morning at 10:30. By that, I don't mean that if you need to see me, I'd be happy to see you anytime, as long as I can work that out. But most of our problem is not what we don't know. It's what we do know and don't do. So let's look at it together and see if this little reminder, this little primer about marriage will be something, and you don't have to put your hand up and say, oh man, you scored on me today. And I'm not interested in that. I'm just interested in being a help to all of us. See if you see something here that might be a help in your situation, or at least to remind you of what's going on. What was God's purpose in all of this? There's three of them, and the first one is fellowship. So where do you see that? That's a word that everybody understands. I picked a word that's practical. I see it in verse 18. It says, the Lord God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I don't know if you realize how profound that statement is. Because everything up until this point God has said is good. Did you know that? In the context of this whole situation in Genesis, everything that God has made, every observation that God makes so far about creation, he says it's good. In fact, when he gets to the end of the whole thing, he says it's very good. So just refer back over to chapter 1, verse 31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. That's not someone else's commentary. That's God's commentary. God's commentary on his own handiwork. And he says, this is very good. And we've encountered that, you know, several times before where he says, this is good. It's good. It's good. Then he comes to the end and he says, it's very good. So we're kind of used to that. And all of a sudden you read this chapter and boom, it ought to stand up off the page. It ought to hit us like a brickbat between the eyes. God says something isn't quite right yet. Something needs to be tweaked. Something isn't very good. I think God wanted Adam to see that on his own. You know, God is such a master teacher. If you think about this for a moment, as for us as teachers, whether we're teaching our kids, we teach in school, we teach in Sunday school, God is such a kind and compassionate teacher. So he takes Adam and he says, you know, I have all these animals I've made. I'd like you to name them. Don't you think God could have done that? So he starts bringing these animals before Adam, and Adam starts tooling it off. I mean, he starts cranking the names out. I want to tell you something else. This is not my sermon this morning, and this is just a downfall of mine. There's so many things popping in my mind, I've got to stay on track. This whole idea that Adam was some kind of a Neanderthal with some club writing pictographs on the side of a cave is a bunch of hooey. It's as much hooey as evolution itself is hooey. I bet you Adam was smarter than anybody in this room today, by far. By far. Could you name all the animals? I'd be hard-pressed. I can't even remember half the names I'm supposed to remember. I'd be hard-pressed, but I'd be even more hard-pressed to name them with insight. And when you go back and you look at those names that he picked, the ancient meanings of them, I mean, he had insight into that. He was no dumb cookie. You don't think God makes dumb people do it? Well, I know you know where you can find some. It's south and east of here, but anyway, that's another subject. So he brings all these animals in, and all of a sudden Adam's saying, they've all come by pairs. Now, here's something else to think about. Because you see this in your own life. Wasn't there companionship with the animals? All right, so you sleep with your cat. It floats your boat. You sleep with your dog. You have a pet snake. Please do the other two first. But regardless, we all understand that there's real companionship with animals. And many of you here today, you lean on them. Maybe you don't have human companionship like you did before. And we all recognize that. It's not the same thing, though, right? is still not the same thing. Because he says, I will make an help meet for him, suitable. Suitable to an extent with a cat, suitable to an extent with a dog, but not the same thing. This is what God is doing. Fellowship. I want to say something here and round out this point. Aren't you so glad that you don't have to face life alone? Now, if God calls you to do that, he's going to grace you to do that. And people here will tell you about that this morning. But the fact that God came up with a plan, knowing what life is and what life would be like, to give you a companion, someone you can talk to. You can talk to the cat, but they don't talk back. Well, they do, but not quite how you were envisioning. It's not the same thing. And I want to go somewhere that I know is sensitive, but I think I need to do it. Because there's lots of folks here this morning, and you've been in that situation, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, and now you're not in that situation. Because for one reason or another, you've lost your spouse. Marriage may have had difficulties, and it happened that way. Death may have intervened, and it happened that way. And I want to encourage you this morning, because you know it is so easy in life to be overtaken with the negatives. For all of us, it's a problem. For all of us, it's very easy to happen. And I think sometimes people don't realize how negative they become. So that, for instance, you go visit with them and all they talk about is their problems. Well, if all you have is problems, I guess that's all you have to talk about. But that's not true, is it? And I want to ask you to think about something this morning. As much as you hurt, I understand that. I'm not making light of it. But I want you to say this morning, you know, I thank God as I look back over life for the mate he gave me. That in the raising of our children, in the building of our home, and all the times that we spent together, God in his favor and God in his goodness gave me someone to share life and burdens with. And even though you hurt because that person still isn't in your life in the physical presence sense, yet can we not look on the positive side and rejoice? Even in their absence, doesn't it make you thank God for when you had them? It's a different way to look at it that may indeed transform and help in your life. God makes those decisions. We don't. I'm not making light of where you are. I understand where you are. But look back on the blessing that you enjoyed, the fellowship, the companionship that you had, the good times that you had. And if you're in a position and God leads you to find someone else, more power to you. Well, talking about being alone, here's an interesting story to think about. Most people, I think, know that Mark Twain was not exactly the epitome of a believer. I'm using what might be called understatement. However, something is kind of interesting most people don't know, and that is that he married a woman who, by all outward profession, was. Her first name was Olivia. He called her Livy. And by all outward understanding, she was an ardent professing Christian when they married. And in the beginning of their marriage, they would say blessing at the meals. They would read a chapter in the Bible together. But it didn't take very long before that fell away. And a little period of time after that fell away, more, she confided with her sister, Livy did. She confided with her sister that she had sort of backed away, we would say backslidden, but slipped away from a lot of her Christian convictions. And then, as they began more and more of their life together, and they traveled and they went to Europe, and his circle of friends began to kind of predominate things, and she heard not only his ideas, but all of his friends' ideas, and then she was exposed in Europe to all of those kinds of people. She just grew further and further and further away from her faith. And finally, a bereavement happened, a trial. And he said to her one day, he said, Livy, if it helps you to lean on the Christian faith, do so. And he was sincere about that. But her answer back to him was so sad. She said, I can't, youth. She called him youth. She said, I can't, youth. I have none. That story goes a lot of different directions, but I'm telling you, you can even be alone in the presence of people. You can even be alone in the presence of people who are very close to you. And for those of you who aren't married and are considering marriage, whether you're young people or an adult, you need to understand God designed this thing for fellowship, but if you marry outside of faith, hello? If you marry outside of faith, you are going to be alone in the most crucial area of life. I go back to what I said in the beginning. God is first, and that governs everything else. So young people, I'm not picking on you, but I want to encourage you. We know this principle. We've talked about it before. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Please, as you date, please, as you grow up, please, parents, as you admonish your children, you must only look for a mate who shares your faith. I'm not talking necessarily about every small conviction, but if you step outside of faith, it's kind of like Samson, right? It's kind of like Samson. It says that he went down to the Philistines, and that's exactly what you're going to do. You're going to go down. And you're going to find yourself in that crucial area of life alone. Don't do that. Please do not do that. Your emotions can get a hold of you, and the best way to stop and keep that from happening is don't start down that road. I don't care how good looking he is. I don't care how cute she is. And you don't need to be stuck up about it. You just have a covenant between yourself and God. I cannot date outside of the household of faith. Okay? It's important. Please understand how important that is. Number two thought for us here this morning. What about the purpose of marriage? Well, the word help is also in verse 2. Take a look at chapter 2, verse 18. I will make an help meet for him. It's developing further the whole concept of why it's not good for man to be alone. It's one of the reasons. He says, I have to get him some help. Verse 20, Adam gave names to all the cattle and to all the fowl of the air and every beast of the field, but that for Adam there was not found an help suitable or meet for him. Couldn't Adam get help from the animals, just like he could get companionship from the animals? Sure, if you need to go somewhere, a horse can help. You don't have a Chevy pickup. Sure, if you need plowing done, an ox can help. But there's things horses and dogs and cats and oxen can't help you with. God is the one who said this. Now, you know, this word for help, yetzer in Hebrew, is very interesting. It comes up in some names. Do you mind flipping a couple pages? Maybe it'll help you stay focused, but turn to Exodus chapter 18. We aren't going to do a lot of this, but turn to Exodus chapter 18. I think maybe if you see this in the context of how God uses this or this is used in names, you'll get the concept that I want to convey. Moses had two boys. The first was Gershom, and it means a stranger there. And it tells us that that name had significance in 18:3. Her two sons, of which the name of the one was Gershom, because Moses said, I have been an alien in a strange land. And he was commemorating the fact that out there in that wilderness, and he was a stranger there. So he gave his boy the name Gershom. It had a significance. So did the second name. Look at it. And the name of the other was Eliezer. Eli. Did you hear that on the cross? Eli, Eli. Lama sabachthani. What's it mean? What's Eli mean? My God. It's ale, the Hebrew word ale, with that possessive suffix on the end, making it mean my God. So we have it here. Eli, Eliezer, Yetzer is the word for help. So what does the name mean? It means my God is help. And that's what he says. And the name of the other was Eliezer, for the God of my father said he was mine help. You see that? God was my help, and he commemorated that. Then look over in one other. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 7. There's just not enough time for all this good stuff. It thrills my heart, but we'll do what we can. So the Philistines and Israel are having a dust up. That wasn't uncommon, was it? They had a fight, a battle. And God gave Israel the victory, and Samuel commemorated that. Verse 12 says, "Then Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen and called the name of it Ebenezer." Ebenezer. You see on the end, the Etzer again, the help. And Evan, the word for stone, and it means stone of help. It was a commemoration that God gave the victory. He gave the help. So I have a small bone to pick with the hymn editors who take the song that we sing, Here I raise mine Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come, and I hope by thy good pleasure, it goes on. And they change Ebenezer. Why should we change hymns and put in something there because people are biblically illiterate? Why not just explain to them what the hymn writer's talking about? What a grand significance that is. I'm sorry, but I think it's done in our hymnal. I think they changed that. Here I raise mine Ebenezer. What a thrill that is. Here I understand God is my help. Or I acknowledge in this situation I never would have made it, but God is my help. And he helped me through it. And here's my commemoration of that fact. Well, you know, in life you need help, a lot of it. And God is so good to provide that through so many different sources, but you know, the closest one is your helpmeet. It was sometimes we smooth that out and you say, well, it's helpmate. No, it isn't. It's helpmeet. Help suitable, help fit that God is talking about here. And God designed this woman in order to be that help. But you know, we tend to skew what God does. And do you know the old expression? I don't know if this is still used, but maybe sometimes it is. But in a working context, or sometimes even in a home, if there are servants, we refer to the help. Right? You heard that before? The help. And that's what this word means. But unfortunately, when we say it that way, it's not necessarily wrong, but it has a mild connotation of someone who is a little subsidiary. And that's not true here. Gentlemen, a lot of problems would be solved if we understood something and got it settled right here this morning. Your wife is not your subsidiary. Any more than God was Moses' subsidiary when he said, "My God is help," or stone of help, any more than he was a subsidiary to Israel. He was the key player, in fact. Matthew Henry, I think that this is probably unimprovable, came up with the observation, God took her from, made her from a rib, not from his head that she might lord it over him. That's a great distortion. That's what men always do, and women, they distort what God comes up with. He didn't take the thing he made the woman from out of man's head so that she would be domineering and overruling and lord it over her husband. That's another fatal mistake. Nor did he take it out of Adam's foot that he might trample on her, but from his side to demonstrate that she is his equal. From under his arm to demonstrate that she needs his protection, and from close to his heart that he might love her. How can you improve on that? What magnificent wisdom there is in all that God does. If somehow we could get a hold of that concept. There's a man, an author by the name of S.C. Gwynn. Tim A. Gartner gave me a book to read. It's about the Comanches. I've got it here. Memory went away from me. Yours ever do that? What's the name of this crazy book? Empire of the Summer Moon. Good thing I looked at that. I was going to say Harvest. I don't know if you would enjoy. I mean, I've really enjoyed the book. I'm almost done with it. But it's about the Comanches, and it's about the West, and it's about predominantly the 19th century. And it really, the whole story centers around a young lady, Virginia Parker, I think her name was, but she was basically kidnapped by Comanches when she was 6 or 7 years old and was not rescued, and so she eventually basically became a Comanche. She married a Comanche chief. His name was Petanakona. And it describes different things. The whole story is there, but I mean, the thing that you figure out after a while about Comanche culture and probably Indian culture and probably the culture of fallen man in general, but in the book, the Comanche culture, one of the things that you figure out real quickly is the men were the warriors, the fighters, and the raiders. That's what the men did. Not that the women didn't occasionally fight some, but primarily, and they did protect their women and children. They would go to great lengths to do that. But everything else was a woman's job. Skinning buffaloes, the women did it. Packing up if they were going to move the camp, the women did it. Raising children, the women did it. Cooking, the women did it. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you here this morning, that is a grossly distorted concept that God did not invent servitude when he created the woman. God made a team. God made a team. And young people and others, I want to say one other thing before we come to the last thought for this morning. So it's not too much of a quantum leap to now figure, if this person is supposed to be a help to me, and if God says that the one he brought to Adam was suitable, fit for him, it's not too much of a leap as you date and as you get further down the road, because a lot of you are not quite there yet, but when you start thinking about someone for a mate, it's not a bad idea to figure out, if you know, what has God called me to do? Does this person fit that? Would this person be a companion to me in that? You know, I'll tell the story. I hope I don't embarrass her, but we didn't get too far into our relationship, my wife and I, but one little advantage we had was there was about 45 minutes between where I lived and where she lived. So we had lots of time to talk. And we didn't get very far into things before. I mean, it was appropriate. Don't misunderstand me. But we didn't get too far into the fact that I asked her, "Do you know, is it okay? I think God has called me to be a preacher. Is that okay?" No sense in going there if it's not. Because we go right back to the wisdom of God in the beginning. God is first. God is first. It settles a whole lots of things on down here with my marriage and my home and my country if we understand God is first. So we have fellowship and we have help. And the third thing we have, and you're going to say, "I wish he'd have spent the whole time on this." And maybe the clock is my friend in this one case. But the third thing is intimacy. Where do you get that? Well, I'd say it's fairly apparent in verse 24 and 25. If you want to look at that again, I don't think this is any earth-shattering revelation as to what this is getting at. "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." It's too bad that we only see one part of intimacy, because intimacy is a broader concept than just physical relations. But by the same token, we sure need help. In this perverted world in which we live, they throw it at you every day. Sex this, sex that. You can't get away from it. If it's not on the internet, in some innocent page that you went to, it's on some guy's bumper sticker, or it's on some other emblem or other depiction. Some of this stuff just rots my socks. I'll tell you, I get up on my hind legs. There's people in this town that have just gross, vile depictions on their cars. If I didn't understand that the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God, I could be tempted with some rocket-propelled grenades. I don't want to see that! Hello? I don't need to see that. I'm trying to walk down the road or drive my car and keep my mind straight, and some guy flashes this stuff up in front of me. Get down the road! Get out of my way! That just... And I've read stories about this thing I got in mind right now where a policeman pulled a woman over. A woman had it. Told her, "Get that thing off your car." She said, "No, there was a big to-do." That's where we are in this society today. But the whole point, I guess, is to say, you know, don't let that stuff keep you from the good stuff. God's stuff. Because God isn't dirty. And God came up with this. And God had two reasons to come up with this, at least that we're going to talk about this morning. One is, we'll just use words that start with P. One of them is a big word, but it really isn't a big word, but to perpetuate. Some folks, how do I say this and not get firebombed? Because this week in Texas, there was a 14-year-old young man who, in conversation with his classmate, not out audibly in front of the rest of the class, the subject had come up, and the young man indicated to his friend that he thought that homosexuality was wrong. The teacher, who was sort of, well, that way, at least in sympathy, I don't know him, just came unglued, and the kid got punished. Did you see that story? So now we've got the thought police. Now you can't even express, but I don't know if they didn't just sort of figure out, you don't perpetuate that way. It doesn't work. It's against nature. I'm sorry, but you can say all you want, but God has the plan. And this is it right here. It's one man, one woman. It's not two men and it's not two women. Well, he made man in his own image. Fellowship is part, to go back to an earlier point, fellowship is a part of God's image, right? Because if you look at verse 26, he says, let us make man in us, the persons of the Trinity. You mean God is a God of fellowship? Yeah, that's why he made man that way. You mean just as God made man to worship and you can't get away from it. You know, you just, here's the thing that I'm trying to say, beloved. We can say all we want. We can politicize all we want. People can stand up and speak and be, you know, they can run you down and you're politically incorrect and just try to just grind you into the point that you won't say anything. Still doesn't change how God made us. And you aren't going to change how God made us. Man is incurably a creature of worship because God made him that way. Man is incurably a creature of fellowship because God made him that way. Not that we don't have different personalities and needs. And even in this last point of intimacy, God is satisfying and meeting those needs. And he's also doing something else. He's perpetuating, because he didn't just make Adam and Eve. He said, be fruitful and multiply. You see that? Verse 28, take a look. God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. So that's one reason God gave this. I don't have time to talk more about it. But I will say this. I think we should teach our children this. And Mr. Kidd made a comment that several of us chuckled at last Sunday night about some folks helping us keep our elementary school open. But I just want to tell you something. We do need to teach our children that God is, in this day and time where marriages are happening later and later and couples are having fewer and fewer children, somehow somebody better get the Bible out and start teaching this is God's plan. How many children should you have? I don't know. Blessed is the man that hath his quiver full. Mine's full at three. I don't know what size quiver you have. I that's not my business. That is not my business to determine that for you. That's between you and God. And I will just tell you this. I'm anticipating my sermon for next week. You probably don't want to do more than you can care for. That would be a good thing to think about, because you have a real responsibility when that happens. But I'll tell you a story about a little boy. He went to his mother and he said, this is the question parents dread. How did I get here? Well, his mother came up with some story about a white bird with feathers. You know the one. So the little kid looked at her. He said, okay. He went to his grandmother and he said, same question. How did we get here? How did I get here? She came up with some variation on the same theme. The little boy went outside and found his friend and he said, you know, he said, there hasn't been a normal birth in this family in three generations. It might be good if we took teaching that on instead of letting other people do that, hey? Hey? Maybe so. And we should teach our children and know for ourselves that God has put us in this position to raise up a godly seed, as it says in Malachi. So whether it's one, two, three, four, I can't settle that for you, but that's what God is doing. And I'm going to give you the second P word, and we'll have to be done, and it's pleasure. Isn't it nice that God isn't against a good time or pleasure or enjoyment or joy? I don't understand some of these people I don't know. I guess what I would leave you here with this morning is if you've lost the romance from your marriage, go find it. It's not the whole thing, just any more than a cake is the whole thing, but boy, I tell you, one with icing is nice. Hello? And just because the world has made that dirty doesn't mean that we shouldn't teach and preach how good God is and how we shouldn't promote, enjoy with a pure conscience, and thank God for one of life's great blessings, the intimacy that He has given us. Now, here's how I want to close the message, and I really am at the end. Not of what I'd love to say, but what I can say today. You know, I really thought about this. What do I do? I don't want to embarrass anybody. But I just hope that you can see how important this is to your... Because, look, I tell this to couples when they come in for counseling before marriage. You know, one of the things I talk about is your finances, because it's one of the big three or four that gets people into trouble. So when you do your finances... The first thing you're going to do is the first thing that we've seen in this series on priority is you're going to put God first in your finances. Because if you don't put God first in your finances, and I tell them this, I've never met a couple yet that didn't want God to bless their finances. Have you? I doubt there's anyone in here this morning who doesn't want God to bless their finances. Well, how do you figure God's going to bless your finances if you don't do what He tells you to do with them? The first of which is to put Him first. So if you don't tithe and you don't honor God's principles with your finances, then you're leaving yourself open for God to withhold some of the blessing. All right, the same thing's true here. I talked about three things, and I doubt seriously that there's anybody here this morning that that's not important to, even if you just kind of want to sit there and look like the Amish. Fellowship, help, and intimacy. Are those things important to you? Then your marriage is important to you. If you're married, your marriage is important to you. Is that worth making a priority? Because you know what? If you're not doing that, it is self-defeating. The very things that you are in line to receive and give in marriage, help, fellowship, and intimacy, you're thwarting by not working on and keeping first your marriage. So I have this to close with. Two things for homework. Number one, and maybe you've already thought of it, we'll take a couple minutes as we close the service to give you some opportunity there, but ask yourself this question: is there an area that I know I'm falling short? And just ask God to help you. You know, we need help. We talked about help this morning. But if you're really brave and really serious, you could also ask your spouse later. You wouldn't dare want to do it over Sunday dinner because then they would know you were thinking about the message. But you could always ask your spouse, honey, that stuff he was talking about this morning, is there something I don't see that you could point out to me where I could do better in these three areas? You're just blessing yourself. And so often pride is what keeps us from doing those very things that would make us happier and more fulfilled in our homes and in our marriages. Father, I pray that you will bless us here today as we've contemplated these thoughts. I think we all see, Lord, how important this is. Bless every dear person who's here today, wherever this message has found them, looking for marriage, looking back on marriage, in marriage, hurting, joyful. I pray that in those quiet moments that we sang about, speak, Lord, for thy servant hears, that each of us would take away something from today, something that will help us to be better Christians, better husbands, better wives, wherever we find ourselves in life. And Lord, if at this particular point a spouse is not in our life, thank you, number one, that we can depend on you. Thank you, number two, for the people you bring in. Help us to all be sensitive to those around us who may have special needs in that way. Thank you for your great love. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.